A little while ago, we were talking in the shop there one morning, and John Wangard, some of you know him, many of you maybe don't. He's an Amishman, works there with us, and he's a minister in the Amish church here right down the road, I think the closest district maybe. But we were talking about, I said, one of the things I covet is the ability to in preaching is to use practical illustrations like Jesus did to bring a point across. I said, "How do you do?" He said, "Well, I find that the Bible is full of them. There are just so many characters and stories in the Bible that do this." And he said, I try to find Bible illustrations for my messages." And I didn't tell him, but I thought to myself, and I thought about it many times since, I could do better at that. I think he might be right. And so this morning, I'd like to turn to a Bible story, 2 Chronicles. It's an Old Testament story, an account. Actually, it's not just a story, but it's kind of a story, and it's a pretty detailed account we have here in the Bible. That illustrates my burden for the message this morning. And for those that are taking notes and want to know the title, I'll give it about halfway through. I'll give us our title. So let's look here at 2 Chronicles chapter 10. And the main character in this story is given right here in verse 1, a man named Rehoboam. And how about one of the school children? Who can tell me what Rehoboam's dad's name was? Who was Rehoboam's dad? Does anyone in school know the answer to that question? Kevin? Solomon. Well, then who was his grandpa? Someone else in school. Who was his grandpa? More than Kevin know this. Who knows? Who was Solomon's dad? We all know that, don't we? Who will tell us? Let me see. David. All right, we're talking about David's grandson this morning and Solomon's son, Rehoboam. Let's read 2 Chronicles chapter 10. We're going to read the whole chapter, 19 verses. I think we know this story, but if you're like me, you'll refresh some details in your mind as we read. Verse 1, "And Rehoboam went to Shechem to Shechem where all Israel come to make him king. And it came to pass when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was in Egypt, whither he had fled from the presence of Solomon the king, heard it, that Jeroboam returned out of Egypt. And they sent and called him. So Jeroboam and all Israel came and spake to Rehoboam, saying," let's stop here, and I look back and refresh my memory on this. Jeroboam was a young man that really showed talent and ability, and he really took a hold of things, and I think it says he was a mighty man of valor, and Solomon took notice and gave him a lot of responsibility. But seemed like this might have went a little too far, to the point where Jeroboam became a liability to the king, and some things were catching up to him, and he took off to Jerusalem. And now when he heard that Solomon was dead, he came back, and these people remembered him, and he had quite a following. See, he was their spokesman here. He's the one that came to talk to Rehoboam. And this is what they came and they said in verse 4, "Thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore ease thou somewhat the grievous servitude of thy father and his heavy yoke that he put upon us, and we will serve thee." And he said unto them, "Come again unto me after 3 days." And the people departed. And King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men that had stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, saying, "What counsel give ye me to return answer to this people?" And they spake unto him, saying, "If thou be kind to this people and please them and speak good words to them, they will be thy servants forever." But he, Rehoboam, forsook the counsel which the old men gave him and took counsel with the young men that were brought up with him that stood before him. And he said unto them, "What advice give ye that we may return answer to this people which have spoken to me, saying, 'Ease somewhat the yoke that thy father did put upon us'?" And the young men that were brought up with him spake unto him, saying, "Thus shalt thou answer the people that spake unto thee, saying, 'Thy father made our yoke heavy, but make thou it somewhat lighter for us.' Thus shalt thou say unto them, 'My little finger shall be thicker than thy father's loins, than my father's loins. For whereas my father put a heavy yoke upon you, I will put more to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions.'" So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam on the third day, as the king bade, saying, "Come again to me on the third day." And the king answered them roughly, and King Rehoboam forsook the counsel of the old men, and he answered them after the advice of the young men, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add thereto. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions." So the king answered not, "Hearken not unto the people, for the cause was of God, that the Lord might perform his word, which he had spake by the hand of Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat." And when all Israel saw that the king would not hearken unto them, the people answered the king, saying, "What portion have we in David? And we have none inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to your tents, O Israel. And now, David, see to thine own house." So all Israel went to their tents. But as for the children of Israel that dwelt in the cities of Judah, Rehoboam reigned over them. Then King Rehoboam sent Hadoram that was over the tribute, and the children of Israel stoned him with stones that he died. But King Rehoboam made speed to get him up to his chariot to flee to Jerusalem. And Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day. Rehoboam didn't know it probably, but we know it because we read the history of the nation Israel. And right here, they were at a very critical point. God had blessed David's faithfulness, and it continued into Solomon, and all through the reign of Solomon, the nation of Israel was a wonder to behold. If we back up one chapter here in chapter 9, we have this Queen of Sheba that came, and she looked, and Solomon showed her around, and look what she says, chapter 9, verse 5, and she said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land of thine acts and of thy wisdom. Howbeit, I believed not their words until I came, and mine eyes had seen it. And behold, the one half of the greatness of thy wisdom was not told me, for thou exceedest the fame that I heard. Happy are thy men, and happy are these thy servants, which stand continually before thee and hear thy wisdom." And she went on, and it was something to behold, the glory and the wonder. And if we back up, I believe verse 3 mentions specifically the house that Solomon had built, the temple, the magnificence and the glory of the kingdom. And this is where Rehoboam grew up. He grew up in ultimate luxury and riches, and very likely an easy life. But here, chapter 10 is a turning point. And from here, we see this indescribably blessed nation turning, dividing. And from here on, it was just terrible to read. And I've been reading through the book of 2 Chronicles, and it's from here, it's war ravaged and idol worshiping and terrible unrest and destruction. Destruction after terrible destruction. The two So they divided, and Israel and Judah fought against each other, and many, many killed. And the Lord brought in other nations to subdue them and to turn them back to Him. But here was the turning point right here, what we read. And often we look at this account in chapter 10 and we learn lessons from Rehoboam, and they're really good lessons for us. The need to hear and accept and follow good advice. The necessity of the younger placing high value on the experienced advice of the older. And we can learn valuable leadership lessons from Rehoboam's mistakes. We can learn valuable PR, personal relationship, from Rehoboam's lack of it. But as I read this account a couple of weeks ago in my personal devotions, what impressed me and stood out to me was some lessons I can learn, and hopefully all of us can learn, from a different set of characters in this account. You know, in order for any of us to be a Rehoboam and to be able to ask and receive counsel, there need to be others who give advice and who will speak and influence us. We need to answer the Rehoboam requests that come to us. What shall I say? What shall I do? Here's what they're telling me. Here's the decision I have to make. What shall I say? And sometimes we get asked those questions, sometimes very directly, like the old men and the young men here did. And sometimes, many, many times, indirectly, we are in a position where we are influencing others. I remember several years ago, I preached a message, and I remember grappling with the thought, and if I remember right, I made the statement that every man will give an account for the influence that he has on other people. This subject has received, in the last 5 years or so, a lot of articles in the news have been written about this subject. There was a teenage man, I think he was like 18, who committed suicide. After his death and in the investigation, they found that his girlfriend, through text message, over a period of, I believe, several weeks, if I remember, had just, when he would express that he was thinking of suicide, she would just tell him to do it. And right up until a few minutes before his death, she was encouraging him to, and telling him that's the thing to do. And that blows our mind, doesn't it? But they arrested her. And I don't remember what the charges were, but the court, and there was a lot of discussion, and the court now needs to decide, is this person who was miles away, who didn't pull a trigger or do anything other than encourage him to do what he did, is she responsible? How responsible? Should she go to jail for that, or shouldn't she? And ultimately she did. I don't remember what the charges were, but she spent a good bit of time in jail for her influence. And this extreme case brings out the burden of my thoughts and my thoughts from that challenge that I received from 2 Chronicles chapter 10. How much responsibility do you think these young men had in the destruction of a nation? They're the ones that gave him the advice that he listened to. How important is the advice that I give to others when I'm asked? How important was the influence that I am on others, directly and indirectly? How far-reaching is the advice, the counsel, and the influence that comes from my life into others? How far-reaching is it? Look how far this went from this point, from what these young men said for years. And most important question of all, what does God's record show? What will I all give account for, and the influence I am on others? I have two main points in the message. The first one I have, I'd like to look, and I just called it the danger of distance and disconnect. So here in chapter 10, verse 3, that says the people came to Shechem. They came right to Rehoboam, face to face, and they asked him this question. And they brought this request. And this request made Rehoboam seriously consider it. In fact, he said, give me 3 days. I need to think about this. And then in verse 6, we have the answer that the old wise men gave. And my question is, do you think that age and experience were the only factors that made these men say, look, listen to the people, give them a little what they're saying and they'll serve you? Do you think age and experience were the only factors? Because then when we get to verse 7, verse 8, and he goes to the young men that were brought up with him. What other differences do you think may have entered into this? I suggest one strong contributing factor. Not only did these old men have experience and age and had worked under Solomon, but I suggest that they had relationships with these people and they had worked with them and there was direct connect. And it was their job as the king's counselors and advisors to know what was and to get feedback and to bring it back to the king and to help make decisions. And so in doing that, they had developed a relationship with the people and there was a direct connection that these young men didn't have. To the old men, their past working with people had built relationships. And it made this a personal issue for them. You see, close connection or a disconnect changes our perspective drastically in life. All of us. It just does that. We could hear a story and we could get asked advice from someone that we've known for years and we're really close to them. And the answer we give will tend to be totally different than something very similar, but totally disconnected from us. The young men that grew up with Rehoboam were likely not sons of the heavily taxed and dissatisfied parents, but more likely they were sons of privileged. That's almost a bad word in our time today, isn't it, in cancel culture? But very likely they were privileged and spoiled children of the top brass with maybe zero connection to the common people. And so I see them as a distant, disconnected group giving advice from a very dangerous perspective. Strong disadvantage. And what spoke to me is, are you ever in this group of young men where you're disconnected, you're distant from a situation, and yet you have influence and maybe are even directly asked for advice, but you aren't really connected? A place where your direct influence or your indirect, your influence in any way may be detrimental or even downright destructive. About 20 years ago, 20 some years ago, I guess it must be, but I remember being at Messiah Bible School, and one evening for chapel, they asked, I think it was one of the teachers that was there, I can't remember who it was, but I remember we had a discussion about the Christian driving. And what I remember most about that discussion is a brand new thought was put into my mind that evening that I've thought about, and it's very true. This man said that people in a car will do things that they would never do on a sidewalk. That when we get in cars, we become more rude and we care less about other people than we do when we're on a sidewalk or in the aisle at Walmart where it's crowded. We become more aggressive and rude in a vehicle because something about being in a vehicle disconnects us from them as people. And it's just another vehicle and another object that's in my way of getting where I need to go. And studies have shown this to be very true. And people who think they know about these things pretty much agree that this is the case, that somehow when we get in a vehicle, it dehumanizes us and our neighbors a bit. More than in personal interaction. And the thought is that eye contact is one of the things. When we're driving, we don't make eye contact with them, we just cut them off. If we're going to try that on a sidewalk, it's going to be a little difficult. The fact that we have made eye contact with them previously or may after, it makes us more human. All right, I hope we're more Christian than that, but I think we can identify a bit, can't we? This same principle is seen, and it didn't even come up 25 years, no, it wasn't 25, but close, at Bible school. But if we were having that same discussion today, immediately we bring in another factor, and that is when we use phones and text messaging and social media, this whole idea multiplies. And we know that to be a fact. People are extremely rude and nasty through social media that would never do it face to face. And I'm not even going to go into all the psychology behind that. I read a little bit yesterday and I'm tired of it. But it's a fact. And if you want to argue it, do your own study. Study yourself, maybe. But that's let's not pretend that it's not so. And so I thought of what I call it a perfect storm scenario in relation to this. Almost all of these factors happened to me several months ago. I got caught up into a situation where I needed to call a man and apologize for what I had said in a text message. Follow this scenario, mostly hypothetical, but played out in real life many, many times, isn't it? I got a few text messages from one of my best friends, and he's really having a bad day at work. One of his coworkers, who is an impossible person to get along with and work with, has just let him have it that morning. And my friend begins to text me and tell me about how terrible this is and what's going on. And he's really frustrated and he's in a bad mood and he's just feeling, he's actually pretty angry, my friend is. And I love my friend and these texts get me pretty riled up and my temperature gauge hits the red too just from reading this. Like, are you serious? This is happening. How dare? This is my best friend and I'll need a jump to his defense. Of course. How dare somebody do this to him? And my reply is just that. And I begin to send text messages back and I sympathize with him and I may even send him a few good ideas of exactly what ought to be said and done to this terrible person that he's working with and exactly what he ought to tell this idiot. You know, you can relate with me, can't you? We get these responses. But let's examine the scenario a bit, and I see it some very similar parts to this and Rehoboam's young friends. First of all, we're texting. So we have the most impersonal way of communicating there is. But more importantly, I don't know my friend's coworker. I have no connection with him. I don't see him every morning at work. I probably never met him, and so there's no connection. I'm totally disconnected. The other thing to remember is I only know a small bit of the details of the actual situation. I don't know what all happened all of last week and the week before and all that built up to this. All I know is about 300 characters of what got typed to me in the height of frustration. And that quick, I become an influencer in the outcome of this relationship. And suddenly I have serious responsibility in stirring up a bad situation even worse. I can do it in about 30 seconds with about 10 words on a text. How responsible am I? What does God's record show? What did I just do? Am I responsible for destruction that may last for years? Have I just increased the situation, escalated it to the point of something terrible? Now, what about if this situation was between my friend and his wife? Or what about if it was between my friend and his parents? Or my friend and his church brother, or his preacher, or his deacon? And you see how this just grows, and that quick, like I said, in about 30 seconds, I can just give counsel that is just as bad as what Rehoboam's friends said. How responsible am I when my friend follows my advice in a heated moment to sin against his fellow man? What is my responsibility? Or what if, maybe not just once, but through a series of these kind of happenings, my friend becomes bitter against God and turns his back because I've just poked along at his frustrations and helped him out and gave him advice like Rehoboam's young friends? The second part of the message, I've just called it, what does the Bible say? And you may turn with me to Hebrews chapter 10 for the title of our message. I'd like to read a few verses here in Hebrews. Let's read Hebrews chapter 10, verses 22 through 25. Verse 22, let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. And here's my title taken from verse 24. Provoke unto love. I see here the complete opposite of Rehoboam's young counselors. I see here the total opposite of my hypothetical and yet not so hypothetical scenario that we talked about. Here is the call. Here's the command to who? Look at verse 22. It's talking to us who have had our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience. It's talking to us who are enjoying a connection with God and who can draw near with full assurance to God our Father because our sins have been washed away. And then he tells us, let's consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works. Here is how we respond, those of us who are enjoying peace with God and open access to God the Father. He says, consider each other. Be alert for the needs in each other. Be alert for opportunities. I quote from another Bible scholar, let us diligently and attentively consider each other's trials and difficulties and weaknesses and feel for each other. It's in these times, in trials and weaknesses and difficulties, that we have opportunity again and again to give counsel like the old man or counsel like the young man. To provoke, he says. And this is not to annoy and offend and irritate. The word here has a very positive meaning. It's to stir up the right response, to excite the best in each other, to arouse, to excite, and to call into action. In fact, my understanding is that the original Greek word that's translated provoke unto love is all one word. And the thought was to excite to love. And it was in the Greek, they had one word that meant that. In the English, we needed, three words here? To provoke unto love. It's a very positive meaning. To provoke unto love and good works. Here's the call. Here's the test for our advice, for our influencing, for our text messages, for our verbal advice, for our counsel when asked directly. Provoke unto love and good works. We have a choice. We have a choice to give advice and to influence others that will escalate a situation, escalate their problems and weaknesses and difficulties, just like Rehoboam's friends. And then we'll need to answer to God for our shared responsibility in the fallout. Or we have a choice to change the tone of the conversation, to de-escalate, to give good words like the old men. Listen to the people and you'll have good results. Provoke unto love. To promote love and good works. And so I just challenge us. When your Rehoboam is very discouraged, do you join the pity party? Or do you speak of the goodness of God? Do you provoke real love? Or do you continue the self-love of self-pity? When your Rehoboam is defying authority and living in disobedience, are you willing to risk looking like a better than thou and to provoke unto love and good works? Because we have a choice. We can make statements that make each other bolder in sin, or we can call each other to the accountability of God, that God holds us. And when your Rehoboam is having relationship problems, do you help him be a coward and hide behind a screen and help him type up that snarky message to set things in order, to just right all the wrongs and just escalate the situation? Or do you kindly provoke to love and good works? And when your Rehoboam is very angry and frustrated at being mistreated and all kinds of unfairness, will you incite more anger or provoke love? You fill in the situation, whatever you're facing in life. What are you doing to provoke unto love and good works? Or what are you doing that may be the opposite? And each of us is on the other end of it as well. And it's my choice. What will I do when I receive advice that goes against what my feelings are feeling right now? What do I do when I receive advice that kind of sets me back a few steps and reminds me that the problem I'm facing, I probably have some responsibility in it? Will I accept that? The choice is yours. We can all choose like Rehoboam, and to choose what seemed more natural, I believe, and hit from his perspective, and then suffer the years of consequences and destruction that always results from poor choices and sinful rebellion. But Hebrews here tells us another important part that I think we should pay attention to in verse 25. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. Assemble together, he says, face to face. He didn't know about 2021 and what we can all do and all the different ways that we can communicate without being in the same room. But it didn't change the importance of assembling together in groups of believers. We all, a year ago, this was very, very vivid in our minds. We were pretty aware of how much lax when we tried to assemble over a phone line or assemble through Zoom or something like that. There's so much missing. And let's not forget all the more as you see the day approaching. The importance of togetherness and face-to-face communication, face-to-face exhortation. That's exhortation here is very similar to that thought of provoking and bringing out the best in each other and the importance of doing that face-to-face. We need to commit to personal time and investing face-to-face time in our relationships as families and as brothers and sisters and as churches, and the importance of that. We all benefit and count on our phones for lots of things and more efficient communication, okay, maybe. But let's not be taken over by that. And let's be aware of the damage that too much of that, or not enough of this, of face-to-face, the damage that is. God says, don't forget, all the more as you see the day approaching. What does the Bible say in this matter of influencing others? I'd like to read a verse from 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12. 1 Timothy 4 verse 12. Let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in text messaging, in WhatsApp, in social media. You fill in the blank. It doesn't change what the Bible says. In word and in conversation covers all, whatever way you can think of to communicate. Be thou an example of the believers in charity. In charity. In spirit, in faith, in purity. That's what the Bible says. Be thou an example. And the purpose of being an example is, the importance of being an example is because we all influence others. No man is an island to himself. We all influence others. This man, Jeroboam, who was kind of a secondary character in 2 Chronicles there, became a primary character. And I think 16 or 17 times the Bible talks about Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. And then it tells about his son who sinned and didn't, and just followed in the ways of his father. And think of the influence that this man Jeroboam and that he had, and how many people sinned and died and faced God's wrath because of him. There's negative examples and there's positive examples. Timothy was one of the positive. He was a Christian. He was a faithful church leader. And Paul said, because of your grandma and your mom, and now you, and each of us is that pivotal link from where we're going, and who many will follow and be touched by my influence. Be thou an example of the believers. Then we have the verse, several verses. I don't think we're going to take time to turn to them, but in Daniel chapter 12, and I didn't study into it. I'm not prepared to go into exactly which judgment and where it's prophetic. But we have a verse in Daniel chapter 12 and verse 3. I think it says about those that will be glorified and called into God's presence and glory. Those who have turned many to righteousness. But the opposite must also be reckoned with. God will judge those who through their influence turn people away from righteousness. And so the choice is ours today, and I believe before the day is over, all of us here will have multiple choices to make. Will we influence? Will we provoke unto love and good works? Or will our influence pull others away from love and good works? Through our conversations, through our visiting, through our face-to-face, hopefully, we will be provoking each other to love and good works today. But the choice is ours. What is your influence on the lives of those you reach? Let's kneel to pray.